Good afternoon. So last time we finished up talking about the lottery scheduler that's in the next homework. Mentioned that that randomness in that scheduler, you know, it's reason why we can have a scheduler with very little bookkeeping that can implement this sort of wide variety of policies, but maybe it's not so random practice because even though it works out over the long term, over the short term, it means we just have a lot of variability, because that's how randomness works. Then we talked about optimizing turnaround time, and we had figured out earlier that, turnaround time, that's about running the shortest CPU burst first. And we thought, wait a moment, we have this corner case where what if something is running a CPU burst and it's almost finished? What should we do if something else, you know, becomes runnable in the middle of that? And the answer is we compare the remaining times to figure out whether the thing that's almost finished is too close to finish for us to want to switch away from it or not. Then we said, shortest remaining time first, that's our policy to minimize turnaround time, and we can't implement it. We can't implement it because we have to measure this remaining time. And we can't actually do that except by actually running it, and by the time we run it, it's too late. So what can we do? Well, we can make guesses. And the key idea we had for making a guess is that, it's going to be consistent. That typically if a program has short CPU bursts now, it's going to have short CPU bursts later. If it has long CPU bursts now, it's going to have long CPU bursts later. It's not a guarantee, of course, but it works very often. So we can come up with algorithms that take advantage of that. And we went over one, which we called multi-level feedback queues. Really, this family of things. And I showed you one version of multi-level feedback queues. And what this was is we were using priority scheduling to handle the approximation. So we want priority scheduling because, shortest remaining time first is basically a priority-based policy where our priority is what's the remaining time. So to approximate it, we're going to try to set programs' priorities to match their CPU burst length. So we're going to use the priority to track the CPU burst length, and we're going to kind of enforce that estimate of the CPU burst length is correct by imposing a time quantum at each priority level. So if a priority says that we think this has about a millisecond CPU burst length, we're going to set a millisecond time quantum. And that means if our guess is wrong, if that thing we thought would be a millisecond takes like 10 seconds, after a millisecond, we're going to stop it. And we're going to potentially switch to something else. And if we set this time quantum, we can kind of naturally get information about whether our estimates are good or bad. That if something doesn't use the whole time quantum, that's some evidence that maybe your estimate, was a little high for its usage. If something uses more than the time quantum, that's a sign our estimate, was too low. And we can use that to adjust the priorities. And the simplest version of the scheme I showed you is just said, we said, JDIT, use the whole time quantum or not. If yes, go down. If up, no, go up, assuming we can still go up or go down. And you can imagine we could refine that to be a little more sophisticated, but that's sort of the key idea, is that we just use what happens as far as our time quantum to determine a new priority. And in this way, sort of our priorities naturally match what we're hoping to estimate, the CPU burst length, and we get something that's close to shortest remaining time first. So that's a practical scheme, and sort of the natural thing which happened, we mentioned, was, with the version I showed you, we kind of oscillate around the right priority level if our CPU bursts are consistent. And if they aren't, we're going to adjust pretty quickly. That at least we're going to adjust in the, if we set something to too high a priority, we're going to quickly demote it if it uses a lot of time. Now, in the other direction, things maybe didn't look so great. If we have a lot of things that are running where we think they have short CPU bursts, and they do, and we have something which we think has a long CPU burst, we aren't going to run it for a while. And this is a problem, actually, with shortest remaining time first, that if we have a bunch of programs and one that usually wants to use a ton of CPU without waiting for I/O at any point, we never run the thing that wants to use a ton of CPU. But for multi-level feedback queues, the problem is actually worse, because it's possible that the thing that we think is going to use a lot of CPU won't, and our guess was wrong. That assumption of what happened before is going to predict the future didn't happen. And so we're just erroneously not running it. And this gives a problem we call starvation. We had it with priority scheduling. It happens with multi-level feedback queues, but here it might happen just because our guesses were wrong. And in practice, there are real schedulers, which are some refinement of this multi-level feedback queue idea, but one of the biggest things they have to put effort into doing is fixing this starvation problem. That it needs to be the case that if they determine a program goes to a really low priority level, that they undo that in some way, so they at least give the program some CPU time eventually. Or else you'll have real cases where some program that actually is interactive does something for a while which makes you think it's not, and then you never run it again because there's other things on the system. So after talking about the multi-level feedback queue idea, we had a different approach to designing schedulers. So with multi-level feedback queue, we said, okay, we're talking about turnaround time, so I'm going to start by using this priority-based design because that's how you optimize turnaround time. And Linux has a scheduler that's at least has been the default for many versions of Linux, called the completely fair scheduler, which started from this idea of fairness, that we're going to first implement a scheduler that's fair, and then we're going to add other things about like responsiveness onto it. And this means that we're going to have to worry less about having sort of dealing with starvation being an afterthought. That's sort of in the design of the scheduler, but dealing with sort of interactivity, that might be. And unlike our lottery scheduler, the Linux completely fair scheduler uses this notion of virtual runtime, so it's deterministic. We just record how long things have run, and that sort of gives us our priority notion. So if something hasn't been allowed to run for a while, it ends up being the thing we want to run next because it has the least amount of runtime so far. And then we just need to make adjustments for doing I/O. So if we don't do I/O, or programs rather, don't do I/O, if they just keep running, then this ends up being round robin. That one thing will have the least CPU time, we'll run it, now it won't have the least CPU time, so we'll run the next thing, and the next thing, and eventually the thing that we ran the first time will have the least CPU time again, and we'll run it. So we end up with exactly round robin, and with I/O, things change a little bit. Also, I alluded to the fact that it supports proportional share. We'll talk about how today. I believe where we finished up last time, we looked at an exercise with the completely fair scheduler. We'll look at another one of those today, and then it gives some sort of talk about some little details in it. So before I move on to that, questions about things we covered last time? Okay. So when we finished up last time, we were looking at this sort of exercise, where we asked how much time this programming gets. And one observation we made is that, well, let's say program B wanted to use all the CPU, and program A had this pattern, then program A, well, it wouldn't get to use all the time at once, because program B would end up, you know, if it wanted to use all the CPU, would end up, you know, having a lower virtual time if we just only ran program B in those 2 millisecond slots. So that means that program B has to get more. And another way we can think about it is that sort of if A and B wanted to use all the CPU, they'd get a half and half split. That's sort of what we naturally do in this policy. So if that doesn't happen, then, well, we're going to try to give A half the CPU time and B half the CPU time. But B can't actually use half the CPU time. If we run B alone with this pattern here, B can only use 2/5 of the CPU time. So sort of the way I would think about it is that we give, you know, try to give everything up to their share of the CPU time, which in this case is about half, because there's two things, equal weights. And then we see what's left over, and then we try to use that stuff, because we're not going to leave the system idle. So sort of the split I get is that I get that B gets about 2/5 of the CPU because that's all it can use, And because it's using less CPU, and because it uses less, it will have lower virtual runtime. So it ends up having lower virtual runtime, so it gets priority. A and A gets about 3/5 sort of what's left over. So sort of that's what we, roughly what would happen. And we have this minus time when A plus B both doing IO. So there's going to be some time when they're both doing IO, in which case we can't run anything. So questions about this scenario we finished up on last time? Yeah?
What was the rule about you couldn't let the process be virtual time be too far behind A?
So question, what was the rule about you couldn't let process be too far behind A? So when we talked about waiting for IO, we mentioned that, you know, what we're assuming happens here is we're saying that there's no adjustments to virtual time for process or waiting for sleep. So in practice, we don't do that because that's very bad. If we just let it get out of hand. We want a little bit of it, but not too much. So presumably in this case, B would always be ahead, so it wouldn't make a difference. But where this would get us into trouble is, let's say B switched from this to just trying to use the CPU. And this, if we didn't make some adjustment, then it would accumulate this debt that would let it hog the CPU for a long time. Does that answer your question? Okay, so there's another thing that I kind of glossed over here about the assumption here that B gets 2/5 of the time. And there's a concern here about what about how our time slices work. So let's say our schedule is we run B, then we run A for one time quantum of 1 millisecond, and then we run A for a time quantum of 1 millisecond, and now B is runnable. And B became runnable here, right? This is B's IO, and then we run B. In that case, if we keep this pattern up, B will end up not getting its 2/5 share. And there's something we didn't address, which is, what do we do about this case where B became runnable while A was running? Do we preempt A or not? And the policy that the Linux scheduler uses is sometimes. And it's based on how far behind is B. If B is not very far behind, we don't want to do an extra context switch to give B its extra like quarter millisecond. You know, that's going to make us do too many context switches. We try to micromanage things to be equal in that way. But if B is like really far behind, we will do it. So it does happen with that policy that we would preempt, so this scenario wouldn't happen, because B will end up being far enough behind A. So questions? This example. Okay. So those are sort of run. Does that we said A gets about, B gets 2/5, because that's the most it can. B gets 3/5. But we have this issue, A and B can do IO at the same time. That'll subtract from the time that A can get, and A might get to run extra if we didn't preempt B, but so hopefully we do, because that's going to be closer to our equalizing virtual time goal. A would get extra time if it wasn't preempted by B when B finished its IO operation. Okay, so let's do this version of the exercise, where it's the same, it's a slightly different, A here does less CPU, and I have a C that wants to use all the CPU. What is C? C is just a program that's doing a big computation. So it just wants all the CPU can get and doesn't do any AI, at least for the relevant time period. So a question, so I guess, do people, so a question is, for this case, do we split it up into thirds? So what's your intuition for why you want to split things up into thirds?
Because of the fairness, so like, if you have three programs, mm-hmm.
Yeah, so you're starting from, oh, we learned that this is fair for total CPU time. For does it in a way we can reason about why that would happen is let's say someone used more than a third. In that case, their virtual time, since we aren't making adjustments for programs waking up for sleep, would be higher. And they would be less likely to run. So the other programs would get to catch up, assuming they have stuff to do. So sort of our starting point is everyone gets a third. And we had the same starting point earlier, but we had the question of can the program actually use that time? Because if it doesn't use that time, you know, it doesn't matter that you're going to try to run it, because you won't be able to. So who thinks that program A can use at least a third of the CPU time? Okay, program B. Okay, so most people... Who thinks program A or B can't use a third of the CPU time? Okay. So the way I reason about this is I think about what do the programs do alone? So can the program use a third of the CPU time if it runs alone? For C, the answer is easy. Yes. It can use all of the CPU time. That's definitely a third. If we run A alone, then we're going to use 2 out of 5 milliseconds. If A is the only thing running, and that's going to mean, and if we do our conversion, that is 0.4 versus 1/3 is 0.333. So A running alone would use more than a third. So there is some way we could run A to use more than a third. And the same is true if B, B has the same ratio, in fact. So my first guess here, and sort of I think probably the most logical answer is that A gets about a third, its fair share, as does B and C. Now some people might have a complaint that they think maybe there's going to be something that keeps either A from getting all of that third, or maybe help let A get more than a third. Can anyone have thoughts on that? Idea. There's things we might be concerned about happening that might make A get performed differently. Yes?
Would return from IO be preempted different process? Is that a performance time?
So your concern is about that we're preempting a different process, and what's that going to do?
It's going to increase the runtime for A.
Okay, so your concern is I've in all these analyses I've done for all these problems, I've been neglecting context switch costs, and that's going to slow things down.
No, I'm saying that like you run the I/O for A. If
yes.
Like, C is going, and then you once you realize that the I/O is done, then you're going to preempt process A over C.
Yes.
So you're not going to give C its full time in favor of A.
So question, I'm not giving C its full time. So I agree I'm not giving C its full time. I think under that assumption, I was saying that C would get about a third of the time. And that would not prevent A and B from getting a third. So I didn't see that alone as a problem, but I agree there's things that we need to think about with the I.O. Yes? So your concern is that what if we end up running B in the middle of A?
No, like A finishes and then B is like, you know, has a dead, so B will run next, and then C is a dead, so C runs next, and then A would be next, but it's still waiting.
Okay, so your concern is your concern is that we won't run A right away.
Yeah.
So you propose one reason is that C might have a dead. I think that's unlikely because C would run in the I/O wait. But But indeed, like, there's going to be occasions where, like, B and A, they have roughly the same demand for the CPU, where they might be interleaved. And when we either, you know, run something else while A and B are waiting for each other, that's going to delay when they can start their I/O operation. And so that might mean that they effectively get less CPU time. Because if we think of this scenario I drew here, where we run, you know, A finishes its I/O, we run A for a bit, then we run B for a bit, then we run A. Now A is effectively running slower because it takes longer for it to start its I/O. So that cycle time is going to be longer because effectively we've added this extra wait, which has the same effect as waiting for I/O, but we're just waiting for B to run in the middle. So unless the schedule somehow avoids that for both A and B, because we can have the same scenario with B, A, B, that would have the same problem. So probably, you know, it's around a third, but it might be a little more or less because of this sort of phenomenon. Questions about this idea? Yes. I'm saying that B could interrupt A's time? Yes, because B and A will have around the same virtual time. So we might context switch between them, and if B interrupts A's time, or vice versa, we'll slow down how long it is until A finishes its next I/O, or in the alternate scenario, how long until B finishes its next I/O. Does that answer your question? And this is just because we have this assumption that the I/O takes a certain amount of time from when we start it. So if like the I/O was just coming in at a fixed rate, this wouldn't be an issue. Okay, so questions, scenario. Okay, so I mentioned that the completely fair scheduler handles proportional sharing. What's the mechanism? They just record virtual time differently. So they allow processes to have this wait. And if you set this wait, you can basically say that 1 millisecond of your CPU time counts for 2 or counts for a half. So if we want a program to run faster, or run more often, I should say, we set it up so when we record its virtual time, when it runs for 1 millisecond, we record that as 0.5 millisecond. So that program is entitled to twice as much CPU as a result. Okay, so that's one proportional sharing. So questions about how this does our proportional sharing? So this is the same effect as in the lottery scheduler of giving the process twice as much tickets for the overall CPU usage. Or same kind of effect, I should say. It's not, the numbers aren't quite the same. Giving it half. Okay, I mentioned earlier when I introduced CFS that CFS does some stuff with quantum lengths. And so they have this dynamic way of choosing how long a time quantum is. So like we've sort of talked about it being fixed, and what Linux decided to do, the people who designed CFS, I should say, decided to do, is they said, okay, we have these two different constraints. So one thing is we don't want to context switch too often. So we're going to set a minimum. And this is a configurable value, but they defaulted to a little less than 1 millisecond. They said, I don't want to ever have the quantum be shorter than that, because that's going to perform really badly because we're doing context switching all the time. And they have the second priority, which is they want to run everything soon. They want to try to run a process every 6 milliseconds so nothing gets starved. So if I have a program like responding to my key press, it runs soon. No matter what. And that's the second priority. So if we have lots of programs, well, that's not going to happen. Because the first priority tells us we can't switch to all the programs in 6 milliseconds. And so they just set the quantum based on sort of these two constraints. The 6 millisecond window divided by the number of things to run, or the minimum quantum. So another thing we need to decide with quantums is about preemption. That one thing we want to do is when something becomes runnable, especially if its runtime says it's really in, we're really in debt to it and we owe it a lot of CPU time, We'd like to run it as soon as possible. Like thinking of the scenario where like B woke up from that AO. We want to run it as soon as possible. But we also don't want to do this all the time, because then we context switch all the time. Like if a bunch of things come in off the network all at once, we don't want that to make us context switch every time something comes in off the network. And they have this heuristic where they just say, they look at the virtual time and they say, is it bad enough? Are we badly enough in debt to this process for our CPU time that we want to run it now or not? And they just have some threshold where they say, you know, if it's way behind the other programs that are running is for its virtual time, let's run it right now, stop the current program. Otherwise, let's just let the current program finish its quantum. It's not important enough to pay the cost of those context switches. So questions about these quantum-related policies? So there are other parts of CFS we're not going to talk about. So one is dealing with multiple cores, multiple processors. Another is that we've kind of talked about being fair between individual threads. But often in practice, what you really want to do is you want to do that for like groups of tasks, like everything in your shell or everything a user is running on some system like Portal that's shared. And CFS supports that. It also supports some special cases for like things I want to be really in the background. You want that sort of thing. And it looks like we spend a bunch of time talking about this one particular scheduler that Linux happens to use sometimes. And it might say, oh, that's only applicable for knowing how Linux works, which is interesting, but it's also similar to sort of other schedulers that have been proposed out there. So one thing is, I mentioned when I talked about lottery schedulers, that the authors sort of have proposed better versions. And one thing they did is they proposed something called stride scheduling, which is basically the lottery scheduler, but deterministic. To do that, there's a lot of extra bookkeeping, which is why we're definitely not having you implement it. But it actually ends up looking very similar to CFS. The ideas are very similar for taking our lottery scheduler idea and making it deterministic. You end up with something that looks very much like CFS with that virtual runtime idea. Also, going way back, so back to at least 1989, in networking, they have their own scheduling problems, which are about scheduling when data goes out over a network. And a common approach there for doing things fairly is something called weighted fair queuing. And the weighted fair queuing algorithm, you know, looks very much like CFS virtual runtime. Completely different domain, just kind of reinvented it, basically the same thing. So these sort of ideas, like many scheduling ideas we talk about, like come up lots of times we build systems that need to make decisions between different tasks or items. And the same algorithms sort of work out very well. Questions about our comparators or anything about CFS? Because I'm going to finish up talking about scheduling in the next two slides. Okay, so here's my sort of summary about schedulers we learned about. So, you know, what scheduler should you use? If you care about CPU throughput, first come, first serve. Just don't do context switches whenever you can. If you care about sort of response time for users, or if you care about I/O throughput, meaning sort of how much, you know, doing I/O as quickly as possible, do something that approximates shortest remaining time first. Why approximates? Well, because you can't actually do shortest remaining time first. So multi-level feedback queues were one approximation. There's a bunch of others out there. The important thing is we're trying to do that, figure out how long it has to run the things that are shortest. If you care about fairness sort of in the medium term, CFS sort of things are what you want to do. If you care about fairness in terms of like how long you have to wait to run, something like round robin is enough for that. And if you care about favoring certain users, use strict priority. And I have this bullet label that's not covered this semester. I'm going to mention it briefly just as a warning. So if you are in a scenario where you have some real-world deadlines, so important real-world deadlines, by which I mean things like, let's say you're designing a control system for a car, and when someone presses a brake, you need something to run within 10 milliseconds to handle that brake being pressed. Do not use any of the schedulers we learned to do that. They do not provide the guarantees you need. There are schedulers designed for providing guarantees like, I need this brake pedal to be acted on in 10 milliseconds or else something really bad happens. An example is the earliest deadline first scheduler. There's a bunch of others. Just want you to know they exist so you don't make the mistake of saying, oh, I should use multi-level feedback cues for that. No, do not. Use special schedulers if you have those sorts of promises you need to make. So questions about schedulers overall? Okay, so one last note on scheduling, which also transitions to our next topic. So we're going to talk about writing code that uses multiple cores. And we kind of glossed over how schedulers work on multiple cores. We've been just looking at single core scheduling. And multi-core scheduling is, in fact, a very complicated topic. And you know, if we wanted to cover it in this course, we'd have to cut a lot of other stuff. But I'm just going to mention briefly, so some sort of big challenges in that. So one thing is that when we're making schedulers for multiple cores, especially a lot of cores, we want that each core to kind of act independently of each other. We don't want to need to have cores sync up with each other, which takes a lot of time, in order to make a scheduling decision. We want to be able to very quickly figure out what one core needs to do without coordination. We also want to try to keep processes on one core for cache reasons, or at least in the same processor, so things are staying in the cache. We don't want to move something around from core to core to core all the time, because that's going to be bad for cache misses. And our scheduling decisions are just a lot more complicated. So when we talked about shortest remaining time first, sort of our decision was, when something becomes runnable, do we preempt it or not? With multiple cores, if you have like four cores, the decision is, if something becomes runnable, do I preempt it on core 1, 2, 3, or 4? Or none of them? So your decisions are a lot more complicated, and it's a lot harder to reason about what the best sort of scheduling algorithm is, especially because that decision impacts sort of cache misses and other things. So there's lots of approaches to this, which we're not going to talk about, but these sort of high-level common ideas are that people often will have schedulers which maintain a separate ready list per core and use something similar to the algorithms we've seen on that ready list and have some periodic thing where they rebalance the threads among the cores, where periodic might mean like every second or something like that. That's sort of a common idea for approach. It's not necessarily a great approach. That's something that works and kind of helps us achieve some of these goals, you know, in a little bit without, you know, notably we're having a separate ready queue keeps us from coordinating between the cores all the time, but still allows us to, you know, not leave cores idle and be bad in other ways from not being aware of what's going on in the other cores. So questions about our brief talk about multi-core scheduling? Okay, so let's start talking about threads. So we've talked about sort of scheduling threads. We're gonna talk about programming for threads. And by threads, I mean not multiple processes, multiple threads in one process. So this is, in one process means the threads are gonna share open files and memory, meaning global variables, you know, pointers and so on, all gonna be in one process. And a question you should ask yourself whenever you're thinking about using multiple threads in one process is, why are you doing it? And there's sort of two categories of reasons we'll see. So one category is what I'll call concurrency, that we're doing different things that are happening at once, and it's easier to think of them as separate tasks that we do in separate threads. So for example, if I have a web server, I might want to have one thread per user of my web server because that's an easier way to program my web server's logic. If I have a web browser, I might want to have one thread per page of the web browser because that's an easier way to reason about my logic for controlling how web pages work. If I have, you know, a game, I want to have one thread to play audio, one thread to read from the keyboard, because that's an easier way to reason about how I would program my game rather than having it all clumped together somehow. So note that when we're doing this, it's not necessarily the case that we're getting some sort of performance benefit from using multiple threads. In fact, we might want to use multiple threads even if we know we're only ever going to run with one core, because it's a programming convenience thing primarily. We might benefit from using multiple cores, but that's not sort of the main reason why you'd use the designs I'm mentioning in this concurrency idea. So another reason for using multiple threads is what I'll call parallelism, which is where we're doing one task, which there's a rational way of doing in one thread that makes probably is the easiest way of writing it up. But we want to take advantage of more resources, more cores. So for example, if we're running a weather simulation, we can probably code that up to run on a single core, but that might be too slow, so we'll run a version that splits up the work into multiple cores. Or we're going to have an upcoming assignment where you're going to implement a simulation called Conway's Game of Life, where you're going to use multiple cores to speed it up versus the simple single-threaded implementation which we will give you. So questions about this concurrency versus parallelism? Yes?
Can you give another example of where you would implement threads but not have multi-core?
Where you implement threads and not have multi-core? I think I gave the common example. So things with, like servers are a common example. You'll have one thread per user or connection. You can do that on clients. You might have one thread per connection for something that's talking to multiple things on the network. Just because then you can write code which like read from this connection, write to this connection, rather than writing code which is like read from all these connections and handle it. So it's sort of a convenience of code organizing. I would say that for the concurrency example, generally, you can do all of these without multiple threads. The interfaces are different, but as we'll learn, there's a lot of other complications that come with writing multi-threaded code where it's hard to reason about correctness. Maybe you'd prefer to avoid that, even if it makes like reading things harder, reading things from the network harder, for example. That answer your question? Other questions? Okay, and I mentioned this why threads thing here because as we'll see that threads have all these complications where we're gonna talk for several weeks about like how to coordinate threads. You know, you should think about do you have a great reason for using threads, because maybe you shouldn't quite often. So we're gonna think about threads with a particular implementation, and this is what's commonly called kernel threads, meaning that we're gonna have a scheduler that deals with all the threads on the system. So I have a process with 10 threads. The scheduler is gonna see and schedule all those threads, you know, as separate things. This is not the only design that has been used for threads, but it is by far the most common today. So an alternate design is that the library code in your process would handle threads, and the scheduler would schedule your process, and there would be some library code which decides which thread in your process to run. And this sort of creates a hierarchy of schedulers. And historically, this was thought to be a great idea. Probably the biggest reasons why it's fell out of favor is that it becomes a lot more complicated to have this and multi-core have things be efficient. Because, you know, with one scheduler in the kernel, we can have it figure out how to deal with multi-core. With this hierarchy of schedulers, we have to figure out how to get the information about multiple cores across that hierarchy. So we're going to assume this model just because it's by far the most common for the threading implementations we'll be looking at. And I mentioned earlier about thread control blocks versus process control blocks. So I have this idea that we have a process control block which like has this array of thread control blocks. So you might think that's how Linux looks, right? We have a process and threads inside it, and not quite. So Linux kind of chooses an in-between point here to make the kernel code simpler. So in Linux, rather than having a separate thread control block and process control block, there's this single task structure that represents a thread. And a thread has pointers to the things that processes need, like an address space or the list of open files. And if we have two threads in the same process, they happen to have the same pointers for the list of open files in the address space. They just share that information. So they just point to the same thing. And that means that the difference between a thread and two threads that are in the same process and two threads that are in different processes in Linux is just how many of these pointers do they share. And this also means that creating a thread on Linux, well, there's a system call that sort of is kind of like fork called clone, where it copies the current thread, but you specify what things you want shared after that. So if you say you want nothing shared, it's basically the same as fork. Or you can say, hey, I want a new thread that has its own address space but shares the open files. Or I want a new thread that shares the open files and the address space and everything, and you'll get basically a multi-threaded process. You can do these things in between. So the advantage of this design from Linux's kernel point of view is that for the most part, the kernel has very little special logic for threads in a process. It just treats everything as a task, and some tasks happen to have the same open files and addresses, some don't. Okay, so questions about this task struct idea? Okay. So we know about low level, and we see that we can use clone to create threads. We're not going to look at the Linux API. We're going to look at the POSIX sort of standardized API for threads. We're going to talk about how to create threads in your multi-threaded process. And that's done in POSIX with the pthreadcreate function. So here I define pthreads, which are basically a thread ID. And my pthreadcreate function, rather than returning the thread ID like fork does, I give a pointer to a thread ID that it's going to fill in. So I'm saying fill in pythread with the idea of a new thread that will start by running this function called computePy. And the other arguments here, this first argument, which I've left as null, is extra attributes about the thread. We'll talk about them briefly later. And this last argument is the argument to the Py function. So in pthreadcreate, the function that starts a thread always takes a single argument that's a pointer to void. Pointer to void means pointers to anything. You can just cast between any type of pointer in this, and returns a pointer to void. So here I'm starting computePy, passing null to it, and I'm also starting a second thread, list thread, with print class list and passing null to it. So what will happen is when we run this, our main function will run pthreadcreate, that will start a computePy as a separate thread, or in pthreadcreate, start print class list as a separate thread. And this looks probably very similar to starting a new process running that function, except that these are all in the same address space with the same open files and so on. Same memory, same open files. Okay. So questions about this code? Yes? Question, if I change something in computePy, does it change anything in print class list? So if, for example, there's some sort of global variable, if I write to foo, if I do something with foo in here, it will change foo in here because they're both in the same address space. Does that answer your question? So it is like fork with that added part of sharing? So kind of. It also differs from fork in that we just run the computePy function, we don't keep running main. Does that answer your question? Question, does it also go back to the main function? No. When computePy or print class list return, the thread stops. Okay. Other questions? Yeah. So if I don't keep running main, how does print class list get started? So this function here, like fork, it starts the new thread and keeps running the current thread. So when this function returns, it's just when we started this computePy thread and we're keeping going as that happens. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Okay, so we have our pthreadcreate, seen an example. So let's look at some code that behaves in a weird way. So here, I have some code where I print about to start the thread. I call pthread create to create a thread, which is going to run the print message function. And when the print message function returns, the thread's going to exit. Then I print done starting thread, and the print message function prints in the thread. And I ran this on my machine a bunch of times, and 4% of the time it printed in the thread, 96% of the time in the thread appeared nowhere in the output. So what happened? Yes. So I didn't wait for the thread to finish, and what was the second part of that? Yeah, so it printed done starting thread before the thread finished, and importantly, because I didn't wait for it, well, there's another piece of it which makes that a bigger problem, is that rather than printing done starting thread and then printing in the thread, well, returning from main exits the entire process. So basically the code which calls main does something like this. So when main returns, it calls exit. And exit exits all the threads in the process, not just the kernel. And so that meant sometimes, because I didn't wait for it, print message didn't get to the printf. It didn't get that far by the time main returned, in which case it didn't print out anything. And sometimes it did. And depending on that, whether that happened, which it turned out it happened about 4% of the time in my system, I would see that in my output or not. And we call this a race condition because we kind of have this race, and depending on who wins, we get different results. So questions about what happened here? Okay, so how can we fix this? So we want some way of waiting for the thread. So we want some equivalent of wait PID, basically. And the equivalent of wait PID is pthread join. Pthread join takes a parameter, and kind of like wait PID, this parameter is, you know, where to put the return value of the thread. In this case, we just don't care about it, so I passed it on. So here, like with wait PID, this will wait for the thread to finish if it hasn't already before we actually return from main. It also, you know, gets and discards the return value because we had said put the return value nowhere, no pointer. But that's not really relevant here because the thread returns null anyways. Some questions? Does pthread create return something? Pthread create returns an int, which indicates whether it succeeded or not. So like with fork, we could be like out of memory, and pthread create could fail, and that's how you tell. And yes, I'm being very bad here and not having examples that do error checking. Does that answer your question? When I say the thread returns, by the thread returning, I mean the return value of from here, what the main function of the thread returns. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? So there's an alternative way, which I don't recommend, but I'll show to illustrate how things work, which is that there's a pthread exit function, which only exits the current thread rather than all the threads in a program, and we could call that explicitly from main. And basically, just like I said, we call, you know, the code which calls main basically calls main and passes the return value of main into exit. The code which calls print message by default patches the return value of print message into pthread exit. So pthread exit is just exit the current thread with a particular return value that we can collect with pthread join. Questions? this idea. So I don't recommend this, but this is to illustrate that, yes, you can exit one thread without exiting the others. They'll just run in parallel, just like separate processes. Okay, so we have pthread join, waits for a thread, retrieves its return value into a location you specify, and pthread exit exits the current thread and returns a particular value that you pass to it. So pthread joins like wait PID, pthread exits like exit. So we know these sort of basic thread functions. How do we write function programs that do something that coordinates with the main thread in some way? So far we've seen, we've spawned some thread that just does something completely different, and we aren't really taking advantage of it being a separate thread in the same process versus a separate process. So let's look at some examples which do that. And I'm going to have an example where I'm going to have this array here, and I'm going to try to compute the sum of the array, and I'm going to try to do so in a way which might take advantage of multiple cores. So in this case, I've split up the work into summing the array into two pieces. I have some code which sums the first half of the array, which is this sumFront function. And I have some code which sums the last half of the array, which is this sumBack function. And because the array is a global variable, both of them can read the same array. And they're going to write their answer rather than using the return value. I just felt it was easier to use another global variable that they're going to write their answers to. Questions about how this code works. So I just start the two threads, wait for them to finish, and sum up the two results I get from that. Have they stored in that global variable for me? Some questions about this code. So if we think of how this executes, so we have our two different things. We have our global values and results variables, which are stored with our code and data typically. And when the threads run, we're going to allocate two different stacks for them because they need their own stack, and they need to be at a different address than our main stack because, well, they're in the same address space. We have the same memory loaded for everything, so we're going to choose a new address for the two stacks. And we're going to have thread control blocks for these two threads. They're going to have a pointer to their stack. They're going to have their program counters pointing at the sum front and sum back code, and they're going to run, and access these global variables. Okay, so questions about how this example works before we fix the most obvious issue, which is I really shouldn't be writing sum front and sum back, which are seems very redundant. How can I parameterize that? Questions before we fix that? Okay, so how do we fix that? So here, I'm going to fix that by I'm going to write one sumThread function, and I'm going to take in my argument, and I'm going to use that argument for the first time. And the argument's a pointer. I'm not going to use it as a pointer. I'm just going to put an integer in the pointer. So the pointer stores an address, so I'm going to choose the address to be 0 or 1, basically, depending on whether it's thread 0 or 1. So I got this ID. And then I'm going to use that ID to determine what my for loop goes over, and also where in the results array I store my data. And the way I pass that number is I just take 0 or 1 and cast it to a void star, and then I cast it back. So questions about my code here. So I have still have my two global variables, but rather than having two versions of the code, I pass the index, and we just have some code that uses that index to figure out what to do. Questions? Yes? What? Why do we pass a pointer in? Pthread create requires that the thread main function take a void star argument and return a void star. It doesn't support any other types. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay. So this is reasonable so far, but you might be annoyed. I'd like to avoid global variables here. That seems inflexible. Can we do that? Absolutely. So what I'll do, instead of passing an ID number, I'll just pass a pointer to a struct. And in that struct, I'm going to, you know, I'll still keep values in a global variable for now, but I'll keep, I'll have this be more configurable. Rather than just having an ID number like 0 or 1, I'll specify the start and end location and also space to store the results. And then rather than retrieving the results from a global variable, I'll retrieve them from these structs I passed in. So in this case, my startup code, you know, computes my start and end indices. So now I'm not sort of constrained to only having two threads. I can easily adjust how many threads I have and where they go start and end in the array. And because I have this array of info structs, I can sum it up at the end using those two values, the values from that the two arrays stored in the struct I passed to them. And the way I'm passing my values is I pass a pointer to a, one of the structs. So I pass the zero, you know, index 0 to thread 0, index 1 to thread 1, and they get it as their argument here. Questions? Comments about how this works? So if we think of how this looks in our scenario here, we still have our two threads. We have thread 0 and thread 1. And they both have a local variable, which might be stored on the stack or might be stored in their registers, that my info that points to some part of this info array. And that info array is probably on the main thread stack. And that's fine. It's fine to have pointers between different stacks because they're in different parts of memory. And it's all one big address space that is shared. And we still have our global values array that all these threads are accessing. Some questions? Put memory layout here before we add some things. Okay. So you might have a complaint here. We still have this global values array. Can we get rid of that? Well, yes, we can just extend that technique. So rather than having the threads know they're going to act on this global, we can just pass a pointer in that same big struct to the thing they want to act on. So here I have a pointer to the values. And rather than having the values be in a global variable, my sumAll function just takes a pointer that it passes on to all the threads. So I've avoided global variables entirely. So there's no global variables whatsoever, just the structs that I allocate on the main thread stack and pass to each of the threads I spawn. So I have the values array and so on. Yes?
What is the disadvantage of global variables?
What is the disadvantage of global variables? So a notable disadvantage is that that means that if I want to like have this code in the library, I need to tell people, oh, sorry, you can't call it twice in different places. It's also would be pretty inconvenient if I wanted the values to have a dynamic size, to have it be a static array. So, and just generally, you're probably advised to like not use global variables because it makes your code kind of less modular. Does that answer your question? Other questions? So you see we have the same strategy, put the result in a sum. So here we have our two myinfo variables. Oh, I have the threads named incorrectly. So this should be threads 0 and threads 1, because we didn't call them some front and some back anymore. And they have this local variable myinfo, which again might be stored on their stack, might be stored in their registers, that points to the info array, and that has a pointer to the actual values, which who knows where they're stored. They might be out dynamically allocated on the heap, they might be on the stack or the thing that called some all. They might be a global variable, doesn't matter. Questions? So one complaint you might have about this is that I have this info array, which is stored on the stack of main, and that kind of means that with this design here, this sumAll function has to run while those threads are running. It has to be waiting for them, and I can't like do anything else in the meanwhile. Even though these threads are not doing the work in the main thread, sort of that thread is tied up waiting for them. And we can't return from this function because then the info array would go out of scope. So we can design things to avoid that because, well, we're just passing a pointer. That pointer can point to somewhere else. So here, I can avoid the info array going out of scope by allocating it on the heap. So just allocate an array on the heap. And that means I can have a separate start function and finish function. And in this case, I just store the thread IDs I need for joining later on in that info array, just because that was a convenient place to put them. And then I can pass that info array to this finish function, which will delete it and also handle like summing the result and so on. So with this design, basically I would call start sumAll and do whatever I want, and then eventually call finish sumAll to figure out what happens. Questions? Okay. So that sort of shows, you know, we can do this without anything on the heap stack, and just here everything's kind of on the heap. You can kind of just use this threading idea to kind of just start something asynchronously and finish it later. So questions about? Okay, so let's finish up by talking about this example. So what is wrong with this code? So here I'm finally using taking advantage of the fact that pthread join can collect the return value of a thread, rather than what the strategy we saw before, where I passed in like a pointer to something to fill in. Oh, and I should edit this. And I guess I will fix some minor issues that you might be complaining about. If you're worried about type problems, those aren't what I'm talking about here. the problem. So, yeah, string pointer should be passed to avoid star star, not avoid star. And we might, and in C++, you would probably need to cast that return value. Anyone have any suggestions? So, if we don't have suggestions, what's wrong? Can someone tell me, what does this code do? Or attempt to do? Yes. So, makes a thread, yeah. So it makes a string, yeah.
And then while this string has other kind of parent thread,
so then parent thread goes to pthread join and waits on it. Yep.
And then what the child thread is done, it sets the result to the string that we made before.
So okay, so when the child thread is done, we fill in this string here, the string pointer here, with the results. Yes, so that's exactly right. So this code, we create a string, and we fill in the pointer from that string. That's passed to pthread join. So what's our problem with that? Yes? So the string pointer is made after we made the thread. So that is not itself a problem, because the code would be the same regardless, because we just haven't set the string pointer until pthread join is called. So that is not a solved problem, but there is something about when things are created and deleted. We do need to be careful about, and that's the right intuition. That's something we need to look at the timing. But string pointer, just because it holds an address, it doesn't matter if we don't set that address yet. Right, as long as we aren't using it, which we don't. Yes. Yeah, so the result, this is a pointer to something that is no longer allocated once the function returns. So this is the same problem as why you can't do simple, you know, a function like return a pointer to a local variable from a function. Same issue here. Like, it's not going to work because by the time we're using it in main, it's out of scope. So the question is, how could we have worked around this? Anyone have, so you had one suggestion of making a global variable, that would work. Someone have another suggestion for something we could do to avoid this problem? Yeah.
We use the ignored argument pointer to put the result there.
Okay, so we could have the main function, rather than allocating a string pointer, it could allocate a string and pass a pointer to it for us to fill in. Yeah, that's a great idea. So we have another one. There's another good strategy we could also use. Anyone? Yeah. We could allocate it. We could do new string and allocate it on the heap. So there's lots of ways of working around it. A bunch of good strategies. Just make sure you aren't turning a dangling pointer. And what happens here is that, you know, we start a thread and it's on a stack that's going to go away when the thread terminates. So that pointer is very likely not to work. Okay, so that's where I'll finish up today, unless there's other questions. Okay, see you next week.